kind of rushed up on me a little bit, and that's when I just pushed him, boom, 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 and he started going out toward the shed. I don't know how many times I shot him, but I just kept right on going, boom, 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 and he just lay in there.
This is Thomas Randolph. He is recreating the moment when he shot and killed a man who had just broken into his home and brutally murdered his wife. It's part of the reenactment he did just days after the incident, wherein he explains how he defended his home and his life by killing Michael Miller. Thomas is straightforward and tries to explain every detail of what happened that night. He fits the pattern exactly of someone defending their home and loved ones, and he should sound that way because he's been practicing for this moment since the 1970s and through six wives. Come with us as we take a look at the life and schemes of Thomas Randolph, a man who buried four wives and terrorized two more, the man who made a good living off of bad marriages. Before we begin, we would like to extend our deepest sympathies to the victims of Thomas Randolph and their families. It was a dry, warm, breezy evening on May the 8th, 2008, when Thomas Randolph pulled into the driveway of his home that he shared with his wife, Sharon. The two were returning from picking up Thursday night dinner, and as the garage door opened, he let her out of the car to walk in on her own. Their home, located at 6517 Rancho Santa Fe Drive in Las Vegas, Nevada, had a two-car garage, but it was a bit too narrow to allow one to open both doors of a car if both cars were parked inside. As Sharon got out, she was carrying a bag with their dinner in it. Thomas turned up the stereo and listened to music as he waited for her to go in. Thomas eased the car into the garage after his wife went at the house, the radio still blaring. He took his time. Inside the home, Sharon made her way down the central corridor of the house, still in the dark. There, just before entering the bedroom, 38-year-old Michael James Miller allegedly shot her in the head from nearly point-blank range. Sharon fell to the ground, her life's blood draining out on the tile floor of the hallway. Let's let Thomas, in his reenactment that he did for investigators just days after the killing, give his account of what happened next.
The bag from charcoal steak or whatever, and it's really a bright red. And this hall light. This hall light wasn't on at the time.
So it's just like so, this?
Just about like this, and I turned the light on myself as we got in. And I could see that red thing, and it was up underneath her, and I thought it was blood. I thought that was blood then. And I started to get nervous about backing off, and I actually came to the door and I touched it and then I stopped and put it back down because I thought, nah, this is, I was gonna go get a neighbor. And I took the, something like that. And about right here when I was like this, I was trying to kind of get a view. I thought I just seen like a shadow or something over this way. And I remembered that there's the 9mm right up here because earlier I'd taken all my guns, put them in a suitcase, was gonna take them to Utah and switch the guns around. I reached right up here, got the gun, and as I got the gun, there's also an extra clip. There's a few up there, but I got the gun and the clip. And I'd already started to run, and then I just reached up just like that, grabbed it, stuck it in my pocket, came around just like that, and about that time he's right up on me. Just right up on me, and we actually touched right about here. And he's short. And when he, I don't know if he gave me an elbow, but as we came around like that, I was kinda coming out. I was actually gonna try to be slow, you know, and look out, but it just happened too quick. We came up and he kinda banged into me about right here, and then he went over to about right here, and somewhere along here I bit my mouth or something, trying to say something like what the fuck or something. And he looked kind of like, and I don't know if he was looking in here to see if there was somebody else or what, and there was a, he had on a sweatshirt, and I don't remember if I seen the handle in the sweatshirt, if I seen the handle down his pants, but he was doing something, going for something down in here. And as we got up in here, and he kind of rushed up on me a little bit, and that's when I just pushed him, boom, 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 and he started going out toward the shed. I don't know how many times I shot him, but I just kept right on going. Boom, boom, boom. And he's just laying there. Just laying there. And I look back because then I'm trying to make sure everything's cool. Kind of stepping back like that. And about that time, I heard the really, really loud noise. And what had happened is I guess he had hit the refrigerator and the... Help me here, the...
Fire extinguisher.
The fire extinguisher fell down. I didn't know what it was, but it made a loud clunk, and I was kind of, like I said, I was kind of looking back because I don't hear well, and I can't tell depth perception anything.
Thomas's story from the very beginning is that he confronted an unexpected intruder, shot and killed the man as he attempted to flee the scene after killing Thomas's wife. The murder weapon Miller had used was a pistol that Thomas had moved away from the man's body at the request of medical personnel on the 911 call. Michael was not supposed to be in the home, and it appears that the couple had surprised the man. Some things, however, just didn't add up to investigators who were on the scene when they compared what they saw with what Thomas claimed. Thomas, in his reenactment of the encounter, would describe bumping into Michael in the hallway but not recognizing him because the man was fumbling with his mask at the time. There would be an immediate break for the garage door by the intruder and shots fired by Thomas. Thomas would follow the intruder into the garage, and after being startled, he would put two more shots into the man's head.
One or twice, I can't remember.
Oh, okay.
Once or
okay.
Twice, and I was still in here.
So he's laying head that way.
Almost head and body kind of this way, and his legs over here, one hand there, and
okay.
That's so about it.
Wait,
his hand would have been up underneath here. So he was kind of laying like this at first. And when the noise came down, I shot one or two times along here.
Okay.
So you still it may have been once, it may have been twice.
Where'd you hit him then?
Pardon me?
Where'd you hit him?
I shot him in the head.
Shot him in the head?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
In the head or up in the back area, somewhere through here.
And you're standing about that?
I think so. I somewhere around in here.
So you could see his head at that point? You could see his face? How was his head in relation to the floor? Was it facing down at the floor, or was it facing up towards you? Was it facing out to the side, to the west?
It was kind of facing this way.
Okay, so
kind of down.
More or less down.
Yeah.
So you probably hit him in the
back. And I don't think, let me think here.
So you probably hit him in the back of the head? Could you tell it was Mike yet?
I knew it was Mike, because of his chin. But I don't know if he had his mask on then. It seems like he still had his mask on then. It happened really fast. I don't know. But
well,
it seems like
he had his mask on when he was
yeah,
backing away.
He had
from you, right?
Yeah, he had his mask on there for sure. But I know when I came out, his mask was over here, I think. I don't know. I ain't going to say that either, because that may have been some of the shit he got out of the house that was there. I don't know.
There's that.
I don't know. So I really don't know. I was scared.
Him now turning and you continuing to shoot and him going to the ground, he's still got his mask on.
I think so.
Because right. So, you couldn't tell who he was yet.
I don't.
When he was facing you here in the hallway, if he'd had his mask off, you'd have known it was Mike, right?
Oh, yeah. And I was still shouting. It wouldn't have mattered a bit.
The problem is that when police arrived on the scene, Michael was not wearing a mask, but it was lying on the floor next to him. Las Vegas Metro Police Detective Clifford Moggs would testify at the trial about the mask discrepancies.
The next thing that I thought was unusual was when he was discussing the mask, how this person had the mask that was slightly rolled up on their face, and then the shooting occurs, and then the victim or the purported perpetrator is down in the garage on the floor, and then he tells me that the mask is kind of lying on the floor next to him. I know when I walked through, I recalled seeing the mask lying there, but it wasn't in a position that it was like it had just fallen off of his head as he hit the floor. So those were some of the things that I thought was unusual that I wanted to address with Detective O'Kelly, and then take another look at the scene.
In addition, Thomas claimed that Michael must have been burglarizing the home when Sharon entered the house, except the house didn't look like anyone had really burglarized it. Once again, detectives explain what they did and did not see in the home when it came to the alleged burglary.
The dresser that we see, kind of more, well, I zoomed in on it in the photo, those drawers appear to be pulled out a little bit?
Yes.
Okay. So in other burglaries and home invasions that you've investigated, would the appearance of these drawers be consistent with what you had seen at those other crime scenes?
That was the first time I had seen drawers lined up that perfectly and not pulled out to the point where you could access the contents of the drawers or the contents being on the floor.
I'm putting on the overhead now, states 110. Different view of that same dresser that you were just speaking of?
Yes.
There's also a television in the middle of the photo, for lack of better identification?
Correct.
The cabinets below it don't appear to be open?
No.
What are we looking at in that photograph?
It's a bag with some clothing items in it that was sitting on the floor next to the television.
Bag obviously not dumped out?
No.
Drawers on the lower part of the dresser not pulled out?
Correct.
And sort of the right side of the bed as you're facing the bed?
Yes, that was another drawer that was pulled out, but it didn't appear that anything in the drawer had been disturbed.
Next was the question of who was Michael Miller and how did Thomas come to know him? Investigators would find out that the two men were more than just casual acquaintances, though. After getting a subpoena on telephone records, it was discovered that the two men had more than 300 phone calls to each other in the 6 to 8 week period prior to the incident. Michael, a 38-year-old black man from North Carolina, seemed an unlikely person to meet up with and befriend a 53-year-old white man originally from Utah. They just didn't have very much in common. Michael needed money, and he struck up a fast and what he thought was a strong friendship with Thomas. Michael would even call back home and tell his friends and family about Thomas. Michael's brother, Rico, and a lifelong friend, Judy Archer, would later tell investigators that they had reasons to think that something was up.
Well, Mike told me, he said he had got a 9mm. I don't know what kind of 9mm he got that from the white guy.
He said that's all it means, all about killing his wife, you know.
During a questioning of Thomas after the killings, detectives push a bit hard, and Thomas reacts as if he feels they're becoming suspicious of him. He pushes back and tries to call their bluff. The move buys Thomas some time, but in a few days, he stumbles into something completely unexpected. He returns to the home on Rancho Santa Fe Drive and finds that officers are there and that the locks on the property have all been changed. Sharon's daughter, Colleen, from a previous marriage, has taken possession of the property after producing a will Sharon had made just days before the killing. Prior to this, Thomas had thought that a will that he and Sharon had worked out gave him partial ownership of the home. He did not know that Sharon and a friend had done this because the two had become suspicious of him. Voicemails left for his stepdaughter Colleen show just how his attitude towards her had changed from nice to vile in the days before and after discovering the new will.
Hi, Colleen. This is Tom. I am just going to try my darndest to bug up and get the cleaning done and try to save us some money to get this house for sale, to get this on the market and get on with it.
And this message.
Hi, give me a call and we'll just chit chat. Besides that, I just It makes me feel better when I hear your voice. Love you. See you later. Bye.
End of message.
You know, it's really weird. We sit there and we talked about the house. I can see it in your eyes. You have lies in your teeth. No wonder your mother didn't like you.
End of message.
Hi, I was actually calling to apologize for getting so upset with you, but that's what happens when people look me in the eyes and lie to me. Now the lawyers are going to get all the money, because I still get half the house because I'm married to your mama. I forgive you. I'm sorry I called you bad names. See ya. Bye.
Thomas would have to just make do with the life insurance policy payouts he would receive after Sharon's death. He knew those were his alone and that he had set them up himself. Without a home in Las Vegas now, Thomas returned to Utah and moved in with his mother to wait out the insurance company. When investigators learned that Thomas had returned to his home state, they made a call back to local law enforcement agencies just to let them know what they were doing, as they were involved in the first stages of the investigation into the murder of Thomas Randolph's wife and the killing of her assailant within the home. You see, in 1986, in that very town, Thomas Randolph had been accused of killing his wife, and that at trial, a man had testified that he had been approached about killing her for Thomas. And a grand jury began debating whether charges should be brought against the man for killings of not just Michael Miller, but for Sharon Randolph as well. It took several months of debate, but the grand jury eventually ruled on January 7, 2009, that charges could be brought. Utah law enforcement agencies were more than happy to comply with Las Vegas's request for assistance in the arrest. Thomas would be quickly extradited back to Las Vegas. Before we go into the trial that follows, this would be a good place to stop and take a look at the man, Thomas Randolph, and the six marriages he had been through. Marriages where only two of his wives were still alive. On August 2, 1975, a 20-year-old Thomas Randolph married his high school sweetheart, Catherine, in a wedding ceremony held at the Randolph family's backyard. She was 18 and a recent graduate. The couple would have two children, a son named Justice and a daughter, Krista. The rocky relationship would end in divorce, and in later years, an old friend of his, Steve, would come forth and say that Thomas had asked him, "Would you kill someone for money if you knew you would get away with it?" Steve would then say that he had been told that Thomas had taken out a number of life insurance policies on Catherine. On the day his divorce with Catherine was finalized in 1983, Thomas married Becky Galt. Over the next couple of years, Becky would become involved in drugs through Thomas's influence and would be forced to watch him when he brought home another woman to have sex with him in the couple's basement. Thomas would once again take out numerous life insurance policies on his wife. The couple fell on hard times, and while he was left to scrape and borrow to make ends meet, he never missed a single payment on any of the life insurance policies, even if it meant having the power turned off in the family home. One day, Becky was found dead in her bed from an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound. Thomas would be brought in and questioned and eventually charged with her murder. A man, Eric Tarantino, would come forth and offer a earth-shattering revelation. Tarantino would tell investigators and then members of the jury that he and Thomas had become friends at work some time before. After Tarantino was laid off, he began doing odd jobs to help Thomas out. At some point during their relationship, Thomas began by saying that he had many life insurance policies on Becky. He then began discussing ways with Tarantino that the pair could do her in before settling on a botched burglary scheme that would have Tarantino kill the woman and then shoot Thomas in the leg before fleeing the scene. Tarantino couldn't go through with it, and he told Thomas that he was out. He then alleged that Thomas told him, "You know too much, so it's either you or her." Tarantino still refused, so Thomas beat him up, shoved him into the passenger seat of a car, drove him to the place where Tarantino's wife worked, and then threw him out of the car and into a parking lot. Thomas then walked into the building, up to the desk, took off the bloody gloves he was wearing and dropped them in front of her before storming off. Thomas's defense in court painted Becky as having been suicidal for years, torn between depression and drug abuse. They also said that in no way did the evidence point to anyone but Becky having pulled the trigger on the gun that had killed her. The attempt to have Tarantino permanently silenced was nothing more than the result of trying to shut up someone who was lying about him. In 2017, Thomas's first wife would come to the trial and testify that Becky had reached out to her for help early in the relationship.
He had a lot of extracurricular activities, namely other women. During our marriage, I wouldn't really call it a marriage, per se.
Did you know an individual who ultimately becomes Becky Randall?
Yes.
What did you know?
She married Tom the day that our divorce was final. And she expressed feeling fear when things escalated with Tom. And I counseled her to leave any way she could, and I would help her if she wanted me to.
Have you carried a picture of Becky with you for several years?
Yes, I have it with me.
Why?
To remind me, I've put all these emotions on a shelf for 40 years, and now I'm having to pull everything back down. But I think that picture gives me strength to express what I need to express for me and for her.
Thomas would plead guilty to tampering with a witness and serve an 18-month term for that, but he was acquitted on the murder charges when the jury could not find him guilty, instead believing the defense attorney's assertions that she had killed herself. Thomas would collect about $250,000 from life insurance policies that he had on Becky. He would also turn around and sue the local police department for wrongful prosecution and receive a settlement reportedly in the range of another $250,000. After serving his sentence, Thomas petitioned the state of Utah and had the record of his conviction and acquittal expunged from his record. But as the saying goes, that's not all. Thomas would marry again, this time to a woman named Leona. The marriage would last only 11 months before she left, and 10 years later she would pass away from cancer. Thomas met his next wife, Gaina Almam, through a classified ad in a local newspaper. The two hit it off quickly, and they married soon after. Within 1 month, he had already taken out a life insurance policy on the woman. Shortly into the relationship, though, a friend of Gaina's, who happened to work for the local police department, found out who the woman had married and warned her to stay away from him. Their relationship quickly turned violent, and there was a terrible incident that happened before she decided to leave him, and that probably saved her life. We'll let Gaina's testimony from the trial speak for itself.
Now, I'd like to talk to you about an incident, soon after the gun solvent cleaning that you described in the bathroom. Can you tell the ladies and gentlemen of this jury what happened at your kitchen table?
Supposedly, I was told there was no bullets in the gun.
That's what the defendant had told you?
Yes, and that he was cleaning the gun at the dining room table, and the gun went off and put a hole in the kitchen floor.
Would it be fair to say that the hole was inches away from you?
Yes, but I could see the smoke actually coming up out of the floor.
As you testify here today, ma'am, do you believe that based upon what you know about the situation and your then husband, Thomas Randolph, that the shooting in the kitchen was an attempt to kill you?
Yes.
It would also come to light that a man named Glenn had been contacted by Thomas during their marriage with an offer to pay him to kill her.
He asked me something about making some quick money. If I needed a car, I can give you a car if you make some quick money. I said, what are you talking about? He said, my wife says, I got a lot of interest money to shoot her and shoot me in the leg. I said, you're out of your mind, man. I said, I ain't had nothing to do with that.
Gaina and Thomas's divorce would come soon after. Thomas, though, would begin seeing a married woman named Frances. Frances would, just 6 months later, divorce her husband and come to marry and live with Thomas. She would also bring along her daughter, Rachel. Frances brought along her own life insurance policies as well, ones that eventually had Thomas named as the sole beneficiary. She also brought along a serious heart condition, one that required serious surgery, but that had to be put off for some time. After the marriage was finalized, though, Thomas pushed her to go ahead and have the surgery. He also got her to videotape a new version of her will. Frances, not long after, went into the hospital and had the heart surgery. It was a success, and she began a stay in the hospital for recovery. She was visited frequently by both Thomas and her daughter Rachel. On one visit, Thomas would tell Rachel to run along and give him some private time in the room with her mother because there was something they needed to talk about. Minutes later, doctors and nurses rushed into the room as Frances's heart unexpectedly gave out and she died. Thomas would refuse to allow them to autopsy his wife's body, claiming that he didn't want her to be cut up again. He then had her quickly cremated, and the remains were placed in some of her many pill bottles that she had accumulated over the years from her heart conditions. He told others that that was what she wanted. Afterwards, custody of Rachel would return to her biological father. Thomas, however, would sue the hospital for negligence and receive a settlement, along with life insurance payouts, that would total an estimated $1.2 million. Unattached and newly wealthy again, Thomas could have just disappeared into the sunset, fading away. Something, however, lured him back to marriage and this rather lucrative bit of skullduggery he had perfected. And that is when he met and eventually caused the death of his sixth wife, Sharon. Now that we've caught you back up, you can see all of the similarities in these cases, just as the investigating officers did. The initial story of burglary gone wrong had looked solid, barring a couple of small details like the mask and the condition of the seemingly unburglarized house, until you look back at the pattern of his prior marriages. It doesn't take much to see that either he came across this plan early and never got to fully execute it until his sixth marriage, or he had been refining the process along the way. And that is what made up much of the bulk of the prosecution's case. After Thomas's arrest in 2009, he immediately went out and hired famed criminal defense attorney Gabriel Grasso. Known for many high-profile cases, Grasso once represented O.J. Simpson in court when the man was charged with memorabilia robbery in Las Vegas. Thomas was readying up for a battle, and he had shown his disdain for the courts already when he was facing extradition from Utah to Las Vegas. When drawn up before a district court judge at that time, he found that he was standing before the same man who had overseen his trial back in 1987, Judge Rodney Page. On entering seeing this man, the Desert News reported that Thomas laughed and said loudly, "Hi, Judge. Nice to see you. I'm sorry I didn't send you a Christmas card again. Hey, there's not any chance you're going to Las Vegas to be a judge there." Judge Page was not moved. Thomas continued, "Judge Page, I'm so glad to see you in person. I've got to say, this is the same coming back from Davis County, and it's going to have the same result." Judge Page replied by telling the clerk, "No bail in this manner." As Thomas was led out, he yelled back at the courtroom, "Thank you, Judge Page. It was good seeing you again." Once reaching Las Vegas and retaining Grasso as his attorney, Thomas settled down into forming a defense. It was during this time, about 8 months in, that Grasso withdrew from the case. He explained that Thomas was no longer able to pay for his services. Thomas would go on to retain a pair of attorneys, only to fire them a few months down the road. He had absolutely no praise for them.
I've done a murder trial before, so I know how it sort of works. The only thing that concerns me about going to trial is these turds for lawyers.
Thomas would continue to delay the trial using this and that tactic, and eventually he did come to trial with representation some 8 years later in 2017. Upon entering court, Thomas was more than willing to make a mockery of the proceedings again. He entered the courtroom now with his long white hair in pigtails and made statements that now people couldn't tell if he was a man or a woman. Obviously, not wanting something like this to be used as a tactic to later declare the trial was biased by his looks, the judge ordered Thomas to cut his hair before returning to court. He did so, and the trial went on. During the trial, a great part of the case rested upon the history we have recounted here, that there was a pattern in the relationships of Thomas's life, and that similarities between the death of his second wife and his sixth wife were far, far too powerful to ignore. A jury would find Thomas Randolph guilty on two counts of murder.
Be the jury in the above entitled case, having found the defendant, Thomas William Randolph, guilty of count two, murder of the first degree with the use of a deadly weapon, Sharon Cause Randolph, imposed a sentence of death. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, are these your verdicts as read, so say you one, so say you all?
Yes.
He would also show up later to sentencing wearing a Dallas Cowboys jersey, one featuring the number of Tony Romo. After being given the death sentence for each case, Thomas made no verbal remarks. He did, however, turn to the press in attendance and give them two thumbs up. Afterwards, he explained to the press in a jailhouse interview why he wore the football jersey to the sentencing.
Well, since I've been 12, I've been a Cowboys fan. My dad wasn't really into football, but the Star, Cowboys and Indians. Then as I got older and started becoming a fan of football, it gives me comfort, and even in here. Sorry.
What's the significance of wearing the jersey today, of all days?
I suspect I'll get up and say something today. It's the end. I was going to wear it yesterday for my mom, but they didn't bring the pants in, so.
Are you able to follow the team from CCDC?
Not really. Every once in a while, you'll see bits and pieces in the game or reading the paper. But that's about it.
You want to take the tag off? Maybe pro? Okay.
And you would think that that would just about be all there is. But there was yet to be another trial. A case was brought back on appeals because his attorneys argued that all of his testimonies from the 1986 trial that were presented by the Utah prosecutor and law enforcement officers at the 2017 trial were just hearsay. They argued that since the individuals were not actual eyewitnesses to anything that had been offered, none of it could be considered as evidentiary. Even though a Petroselli hearing was held before the trial to determine whether the information would be admissible, the original decision had been made in error. They argued that since it was hearsay, it could only potentially prejudice a jury that heard it. In short, since the man had been acquitted in that trial, by presenting the evidence again in this manner, jurors might be inclined to view him not purely on the grounds of what had happened in this particular instance. In short, rumors of past deeds could make suspicions look like truths in this case. Thomas was granted a new trial and returned to court in 2023. The case was heard again, with a mind to stick to what was pertinent to this date and time. While much of the content remained the same, two of Sharon's friends added in information that pointed to Sharon's suspicions that she was going to come to a bad end at Thomas's hands or his plans. Antoinette Beam, a friend of Sharon, talked about her relationship with the woman and then a very peculiar thing that Sharon and Thomas did right before the fateful day.
There were times when Sharon was upset because Tommy had been seeing someone else, right?
Yes, her friend, so I'm allowed to tell her, you know, I don't think someone should be planning her death.
Another one, this time one who worked at a hair salon with Sharon, told how she had been told it was an unhappy marriage. She said that Sharon's fears led her to get the new will, one done just a scant few days before she met her untimely death.
The marriage was going well, poorly.
Very bad.
On how many occasions do you think you expressed concerns to Sharon?
Probably every time I would talk to her.
I'm over here, ma'am. If you could just look this way.
Sure.
Thank you. And just for the record, I mean, you appear to be glaring at Tommy as you sit here today. You'd agree with that assessment, right?
Yes.
Because you pretty much hate him, don't you?
I wouldn't say that I hate him.
Okay, use your word. What is it that you have for him?
I abhor him.
In relatively short order, a jury once again found Thomas Randolph guilty of 2 counts of murder. Rather than being sent to death row, however, he would now be serving a life sentence. Prosecutors said at the time, at his age, death would eventually come for him anyhow. It is a sad and sordid tale, but now a man known to many as the Black Widower is behind bars with no chance of parole or pardon. There is a lot to be said that justice was slow but sure. Still, one has to wonder what would have happened to the people that he crossed later on if he had been found guilty for the 1987 murder. We can never really know.